Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
England may not share our enthusiasm for July 4th, for obvious reasons, but that is not stopping fireworks from blasting through the British banking system. The chairman and the CEO of Barclays are both now gone in a scandal over an interest rate that could affect your mortgage and student loans. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is your Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the third day of July. This month marks 2 years since the passage of the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Law, but there is a fresh reminder today that we still have a long way to go before confidence is restored to banking and financial markets. Today, one day after the chairman of Barclays Bank stepped down, the CEO and chief operating officer of the British bank resigned. It all comes after the bank admitted to U.S. and British regulators that it engaged in a type of price fixing on a global key interest rate. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore joins us to explain. Hello.
Hi.
So let's briefly review what exactly happened here. Talk to us about the LIBOR.
Sure. It's a little laborious to think about, but it's actually not so hard. So LIBOR is an interest rate and it's set in London. What it tells us is about the health of the banking system, right? All the banks in London get together every day and they tell us what other banks are charging them to lend. So it's just like the interest rate on your credit card. If you have a low interest rate, then your credit is great and everyone trusts you. And if you have a high interest rate, things aren't looking so good. So the allegation here is that Barclays tried to rig the interest rate to make itself look like it had a lower lending rate than it really did, which would mean that Barclays was doing really well and it was flush with money and everyone wanted to lend money to it.
Why are American mortgages, student loan rates, why are they tied to something in London?
Sure. Well, there are no more country borders, right? It's an international world of finance. So when you have an adjustable rate mortgage or a student loan or a car loan here in the U.S., it's actually being chopped up and sold to investors in the rest of the world. And those investors, the same way that they use Celsius and Metric, like to use LIBOR. So it's really a global rate that reflects a global financial system.
But who died and made LIBOR the king?
Well, you know, the rest of the world is bigger than the U.S. in many ways. So we do have to play by their rules. But it also really, it helps you get credit because if you have more investors who are willing to buy your loans overseas, it means that there's more money coming here into the U.S. So we shouldn't be too bitter about LIBOR.
Well, you know, Heidi, you and I have spoken over the years since the financial crisis about, you know, all of these issues that keep popping up within the banking system. And, you know, here we are 2 years from out of Dodd-Frank and people still question, you know, why should I trust? Why should I put my money in a system that seems to be rigged against me?
Yeah, this is a major trust issue for banks. I mean, leaving aside the actual technicalities of some interest rate that you may or may not care about,
right,
this really is about people in the market getting together to fix things to their advantage. And it's a very wide investigation. It's not just Barclays. This involves every American bank and most of the European ones. So Bank of America, Citigroup, all of those are being investigated. We don't know the results yet. And it really makes us wonder, can we trust people in finance to do their jobs in a way that we can trust?
And what's the answer?
That answer is up in the air, sorry to say.
Yeah. Well, at the very least, the CEO and the chairman of Barclays are gone. I'm curious, why is it that British bank executives quit while ours just linger on and on and on?
Their lawmakers are much meaner. Yeah. I think that's part of it. Our Congress goes pretty soft on corporate executives, but in England, they don't have those reservations. I mean, they will come out swinging, and they really take this kind of thing seriously. In fact, in the Barclays case, there might be some evidence that the lawmakers and the regulators influenced Barclays to try to play by their rules. So it's going to be a really interesting hearing tomorrow.
All right. Our New York Bureau Chief, Heidi Moore, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And now, Biff, let's head on over to the Weather Center, where Jackie is working to make sure we all have a beautiful day tomorrow. Jackie? Well, guys, we have big changes coming in the weather. A ridge of high pressure has pushed TV's Weather Channel into a sunny acquisition of the online forecasting service Weather Underground. If you're under a dense fog advisory as to what all this means, here's Marketplace's Adrienne Hill.
The Weather Channel is, if we're being completely honest, weather entertainment. It's weather light. But it wasn't always that way. Larry Gerbrandt is with the media research firm Media Valuation Partners.
They've been expanding into longer form programming in an effort to try to change the rating and the viewing dynamic.
Constant weather updates just didn't make for television most people wanted to watch for any length of time. So the Weather Channel added shows like Wake Up with Al and Pyros about people who blow stuff up. Their meteorologists are also pretty cute. The Weather Underground, a website, is, well, nerdier weather. Telegenicness not required.
There certainly is a geekiness to the those who use the Weather Underground, including myself.
Paul Knight is a climatologist at Penn State. He says the Weather Underground users go to the site to look at specific weather data, the weather minutiae.
Whereas the Weather Channel tends to kind of fix it up for you and make it a little bit more palatable.
Knight thinks it's going to work out for both sides, but the potential for culture clash has some Weather Underground users anxious. Among the comments on a post at Weather Underground about the sale, sad day for the world of online weather and the beginning of the end. Dr. Jeff Masters, a founder of Weather Underground, says in a blog post the sale will help them create new products, and he promises the website and brand will continue to exist in its current form. No pyros or blowing up needed. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, investors worked half the day before heading out for the holiday and sent stocks in the same direction as tomorrow's fireworks. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Okay, everybody who honeymooned at Niagara Falls, stand up. I see that's quite a few of you. A lovely spot, to be sure, but you visited and then you left. Perhaps you'd be interested in going back for good. The city of newly betrothed love would love to have you. So much so that it's willing to pay off some of your student loans. It is the latest municipality to offer incentives for people to move there, and the city of 51,000 residents says even a small influx will make a big difference, Marketplace's Eve Tro reports.
Niagara Falls Mayor Paul Deister already has more than 200 applications from around the country for 20 spots. The chosen few will get up to $7,000 to pay back student loans if they move to Niagara Falls for 2 years. While that might not be enough to lure a stranger, it could convince a University of Buffalo alum who's toyed with the notion of moving back.
People that have connections of some sort, family connections or other cultural ties, are very fertile ground.
The mayor says it's really about housing. Participants will all live near downtown in an area targeted for development.
We think that 20 urban pioneers is probably enough to tip the neighborhood.
It has boosted morale for locals to see Niagara Falls make headlines with the program, including Kristen Cassio, who grew up nearby. Her entertainment job in Los Angeles won't allow her to move back, but she says the incentive is more than economic. It's
the opportunity to be a part of something.
Since the recession, she says, community is more important to people. Other cities have tried to lure the best and the brightest. Kalamazoo, Michigan famously offered free college tuition for families with kids. When you add college grads to a town, wages do go up across the board, says Harvard economist Edward Glaser, author of Triumph of the City. But he says cash incentives are not the key to sustainable growth. That takes
getting the basics of urban government right. Good schools, safe streets, taxes as low as possible.
Who knows? Niagara Falls' new residents may help the city do just that. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Now we're going to talk about angels. Not the ones with wings or the ones that wear red uniforms and play in Anaheim. No, this kind flits around Silicon Valley, showering money on startups, angel investors. Now, these aren't the big venture capitalists who spend millions of dollars of other people's money. No, angels fund the very early stages of startups looking to get in on the next big thing. And a lot of angel money ends up in purgatory. But as Marketplace's Queena Kim reports, that is the price of innovation.
Here's a word you hear a lot of in Silicon Valley, frothy. Frothy is what happens when money chases every startup out there.
There's a lot of lemmings being funded.
Peter Wendell teaches entrepreneurship at Stanford Business School.
Look in Groupon space, for example. There's 50 or 60 companies that do essentially what Groupon does that have gotten at least angel funding.
Wendell says angel money can be hard to track, but
last year, somewhere around 60,000 angel investors probably invested around $22 or $23 billion.
I saw some of this money in action recently at the Plug and Play Expo.
All right, thanks, y'all. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Music Prodigy. And I've been playing.
The expo takes place in a dark auditorium inside a nondescript office park in Sunnyvale. 30 entrepreneurs from around the world pay $2,000 each for a chance to pitch their ideas to angels and venture capitalists.
So we are presenting the coolest music discovery interface out there. That's
and investors are trying to figure out if any of these guys, and they were all guys, were worth betting on. It's American Idol meets Vegas meets PowerPoint.
What if drivers could get money from data coming from their car?
The vehicle now we're looking for $500,000 of an angel round of your honey.
Plug and Play puts on 4 expos a year, and they're pretty high profile. But with so many angel investors hungry to fund startups, these types of matchmaking parties are popping up all over the Bay Area.
I look at 100 deals a week, probably.
David Cohen is a member of Sandhill Angels, a group of about 60 investors, mostly tech professionals. I met him at the expo.
I was just at Pitch Crawl last night where I got pitched by 20 different startups. And of course, I'm here again.
It doesn't take much to be an angel these days because funding a startup is cheaper than ever. In the last tech boom, it took at least $1 million to start up a tech company. Today, it takes a few hundred thousand. Startups can plug into cheap or free web services instead of creating everything from scratch. Early in the cycle, the flood of investor money is essential. Innovation requires lots of failure, and that requires lots of money. But at some point, all that money stops driving big ideas and starts driving up costs.
The price of all these natural resources of the startup, engineering talent, of sales talent, rise greatly. It also makes it harder to turn a profit.
Kevin Hartz is an angel investor who was in on PayPal and Pinterest, but he moved to the sidelines about a year ago. Veteran angels like Hartz believe that the real winners of a tech boom emerge when the silly money dries up.
PayPal, Google, Apple, Netflix, once all the pets.coms and so on had gone out of business, they were given the ability to build great long-standing businesses.
Back at the Plug and Play Expo, after the first round of pitches ends, investors pour into a large sunlit room where entrepreneurs and their teams show off their mobile apps and web pages.
Products available on iPad, iPhone, and iPod Touch.
It's a feeding frenzy. Long lines are forming at tables. And angel investor Tom Chu says a valuable lesson is playing out right in front of our eyes.
You see a lot of rookie angels who just made their first millions and they got excited on every single idea.
And it's just a matter of time until those ideas fail, the froth dries up, and the bubble, well, you know what the bubble does. In San Francisco, I'm Queena Kim for Marketplace.
Coming up, the Wealth Gap, Colonial Times Edition.
In 1774, the top 1% of households got 9.3% of income.
But first, let's do the numbers. The markets kept it short and sweet today in an abbreviated session. The Dow picked up 0.5%, 72 points, to close at 12,943. The Nasdaq rose 0.8%, 24 points, to end at 2976. And the S&P 500 popped up 0.6%, 8 points, to finish at 1374. That is the highest finish in 2 years. Goldman Sachs added 1.5%, Morgan Stanley picked up 1%, and J.P. Morgan Chase and Wells Fargo both were down a fraction of a percent. OraSure Technologies shot up 5% today on FDA approval of the first at-home HIV test kit. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.63%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at the events coming up Wednesday. Well, for one thing, it's a holiday. Smack in the middle of the week. How convenient. Markets are closed. Last year, when the 4th of July mercifully fell on a Monday, U.S. imports of American flags were valued at $3.6 million. Most of those flags were made in China. And President Obama hosts an Independence Day bash on the South Lawn of the White House. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Tess Viglund in for Kai Rizdahl. Homeowners here in California have some new protections against losing their homes. The state legislature passed a law yesterday that sponsors are calling a homeowner's bill of rights. Supporters say the changes will prevent unnecessary foreclosures, but the industry is warning that similar legislation being considered in other states could just create new bottlenecks to a housing recovery. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
One of the targets of the California legislation is a practice known as dual tracking. Even struggling homeowners who've applied for a restructured loan and more affordable payments can still face foreclosure.
Unfortunately, the very common story is that the homeowner who is in the process of playing by the rules and paying the modified loan payment is foreclosed upon.
Kamala Harris is California's attorney general. She says the new measure will halt the foreclosure process until there's a decision on the modified loan application. Too often, she says, the bank's left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing, so banks will be required to provide the homeowner with a single point of contact. The legislation also takes aim at a practice known as robo-signing. Banks using bogus paperwork can find themselves in court.
The homeowner can stop the foreclosure process. And, of course, if the robo-signing has occurred and they've been foreclosed upon, then we have teeth in our bill, which would allow the homeowner to seek recourse and accountability if the rules have been broken.
The banking industry is cautioning lawmakers not to make matters worse by creating a new wave of lawsuits that will cause a new glut of delinquent mortgages. Beth Mills speaks for the California Bankers Association.
When litigation is involved, that typically prolongs the process, which takes more than 300 days already in California. If we get foreclosures tied up in the courts, that'll just inhibit the housing recovery.
The Golden State isn't alone in rethinking foreclosure laws. The National Conference of State Legislatures reports changes are being considered in at least 25 states. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Yesterday, we talked to farmer Ace Billups in Hill City, Kansas. The searing heat wave across large swaths of the U.S. is killing his crops. One question we asked him was whether events like this ever make him rethink his chosen profession.
If this here would have hit this bad 20, 30 years ago, you know, it might have took you out in 1 year, but it's going to take a lot more than that to get rid of us. But some younger kid, I mean, it's pretty depressing.
But even for younger farmers, it turns out this may be a great time to be working the land. We're joined now by someone who kind of straddles both the rural and the urban world. Chrystia Freeland is the editor of Thomson Reuters Digital, and her father just happens to operate a big farm in Alberta, Canada. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, you write about this in the current Atlantic magazine, and your family have been farmers going all the way back to, what, the 1910s?
Yes, my dad still farms where my great-grandfather's homestead was.
Well, it seems like it would be really hard to be a farmer nowadays, probably always. But your article reads the opposite. In fact, you quote someone from the Federal Reserve saying farmers are flush with cash. Why is that?
It's really two reasons. One is we are in the middle, maybe really the beginning of a global commodity boom. the rise of the emerging markets, the fact that hundreds of millions of people in China, in India, are getting richer means there's a lot more demand for food. The other thing is the technology revolution, the efficiency revolution that we're all very familiar with when it comes to manufacturing, that has happened on farms too.
Yeah, in fact, you mentioned that before World War II, it took 100 man hours to produce 100 bushels of corn, and now it takes 2 hours. Can you give us some examples of what that technology is?
So right now, when I was a kid, when I was a teenager, I used to work on my dad's farm. It was how I spent my summers, and I really enjoyed it. I could get a great tan that way. And I said to my dad this spring that, you know, maybe I'd like to take a week off and come work on the farm again. And he sort of very politely and gently said, probably that's not such a good idea because I'm not qualified to drive the equipment anymore.
Wow.
It's not mechanized, but computerized. So your combine is connected to your seed drill. So your seed drill, you know, and this works over years, but your seed drill then knows what you harvested the previous year. And that influences how much you seed, how much fertilizer you put in different parts of the field. So less of your seed, less of your fertilizer is wasted. And that's really important because agricultural inputs are expensive.
You mention in the piece that, your dad is, shall we say, not a struggling poor farmer. And, you know, the gentleman from the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City certainly backs that up. But certainly there must be a lot of struggling farmers.
Well, there's a real winner-take-all process going on. And what has happened is if you are able to farm at scale, and this is a crucial point, you know, my dad can run a farm successfully because he's been at it for a long time, because, you know, he farmed with my grandfather, he farmed with his own grandfather, and so he owns a lot of land. And that is what makes it economically effective. If you or I wanted to start our own farm right now without that capital in place, we wouldn't be able to do it. And if you're someone who, say, owns 200 or 300 or 400 acres and that's it, you're going to have a very, very hard time surviving. And probably, you know, you'll end up selling to one of the bigger farmers.
You speak very fondly of your memories of being on the farm. Any chance you would give up the big city life someday and go back?
Well, what I say to my dad is I would just like him to hang on long enough for me to get to be sufficiently successful that I can spend, you know, 3 or 4 months on the farm and do my day job in journalism the rest of the year. we're negotiating.
Krista Freeland is the editor of Thomson Reuters Digital, and her article about today's modern farming is in the current issue of The Atlantic magazine. Thanks so much for being with us.
Pleasure.
This will come as a surprise to exactly no one, but that giant transportation bill passed by Congress last week, well, it has some elements that do not involve transportation. One example, it changes the definition of a tobacco manufacturer to include businesses that let smokers roll their own cigarettes. As Marketplace's David Gura tells us, the change means convenience stores and other little guys in the tobacco business now face the same taxes as big tobacco.
A roll-your-own machine is the size of an ATM. It's even got a touchscreen. Here's a web ad for one of them called the Freedom Filler.
We'll insert the tubes, pour our tobacco into the hopper, press the start button, and now we're ready to roll high-quality cigarettes. It's just that simple.
It can make the equivalent of a carton of cigarettes in 8 minutes. Steve Marasha is an analyst with Capital Securities Management. He says roll-your-own machines became popular as the price of a pack of cigarettes went up.
The tobacco taxes, in essence, helped push people towards this, where you can get cheaper cigarettes.
Tobacco companies have argued these cigarettes should be treated like any other. Philip Morris told us today that means they should be taxed and regulated by the FDA. That's bad news for Phil Accardino. He runs RYO Machines, RYO like Roll Your Own.
This is the end of our business. There is no strategy going forward. This is a law.
He says shops that own these machines are retailers, not manufacturers. The machines, he says, are like coffee grinders at the grocery store. Samantha Shepard works at Let's Roll Tobacco in Bay City, Michigan. She says she thinks the store will stay open, but it's taking a big hit.
We had to let go 4 workers, so that's 4 jobs.
the machines, Shepard says, are sitting in the store, unplugged. In Washington, I'm David Gura from Marketplace.
In Philadelphia this week, people from across the country are gathering in the same spot where the Declaration of Independence was signed a couple hundred years ago. They are hoping to come up with their own document outlining the future of the Occupy movement. Now, all this talk of the 1% and the 99% around Independence Hall got us wondering. Back in the days when Thomas Jefferson penned that famous phrase, "All men are created equal," how equal was America in terms of income and wealth distribution? From the Marketplace Wealth and Poverty Desk, Chrissy Clark has some answers.
Back in the 1770s in colonial America, nobody was using terms like the 1% or the 99%. But if they had, this is what they would have found, according to Jeffrey Williamson, a retired economics professor at Harvard.
In 1774, the top 1% of households got 9.3% of income.
Compare that to America today, when the top 1% is bringing in about 20% of income. 9% versus 20%.
Wow.
Wow.
Even when you include slaves, Williamson says, America was actually the most egalitarian country in the world when it came to the difference between rich and poor. So what did the founding fathers have to say about that? I called up a guy who should know.
Hello, my dear citizens. This is Thomas Jefferson.
Actually, it's Clay Jenkinson, a historian and Jefferson impersonator. And he says the writer of the famous phrase, "All men are created equal," thought a lot about income inequality. In a letter to a friend describing the 13 colonies, he wrote, "The great mass of our population consists of laborers. The rich are few and of moderate wealth."
Can any condition of society be more desirable than this?
Jenkinson says Jefferson believed,
if you had a wild gap between the lives of the masses and the lives of the rich, that you would produce the French Revolution.
So why was income so much more equally distributed back then? A lot of it had to do with the fact that we were a new country, with plenty of land for the farming and even more out west for the next generation. By the Industrial Revolution, we were closer to the wide gap between rich and poor that's common today. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, we took to the Twitters today and asked how your 4th of July would be different this year, either because of a bad economy or maybe the bad weather. Then we had some Marketplace staffers do interpretive vocals of your tweets.
Normally host our entire family at our house. Haven't had power since Friday and won't get it back until next week.
Not launching fireworks at our house. Cannot risk losing the hay crop. Kansas is very dry.
Canceling our party because of fire bans and no fireworks. We normally host a snack buffet potluck. Very affordable.
Are you celebrating the 4th a little differently this year? Well, tweet us at MarketplaceAPM or go to our Facebook page. And that is Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow picked up 0.5%, 72 points. The NASDAQ rose 0.8%, that's 24 points. And the S&P 500 popped up 0.6%, 8 points. Thanks to Bridget Bodner, Mary Dew, Justin Ho, and Liza Madry on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Tess Vigeland. See you back here tomorrow, and have a great 4th. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.